Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the February 10th, Thursday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today, we will be reading the following main articles. COVID-19, DPS to lift mask mandate soon, by Jessica Seaman. Pandemic restrictions, under pressure to ease up, Biden weighs new response, by Zeke Miller. Mother receives 16 years in prison, by Shelley Bradbury. And police issue warrant for Peters, by Saja Hindi. And following up with miscellaneous articles. COVID-19, DPS to lift mask mandate soon. Denver, other metro area counties, and requirement due to case decline, by Jessica Seaman, The Denver Post. Denver Public School students and staff members can stop wearing masks later this month when the county lifts the requirement for K-12 schools and childcare facilities, but the district will still strongly recommend face coverings in its buildings, said Superintendent Alex Marrero in a letter to parents on Wednesday. Denver, which dropped its mask mandate for businesses last week, is joining other metro area counties, including Jefferson, Arapahoe, and Adams counties, in ending its requirement for schools and childcare facilities amid a decline in COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations. The decision comes as other states, such as Massachusetts and Oregon, also are relaxing policies aimed at reducing the spread of the coronavirus. Coming out of Omicron, we're now at a different phase of the pandemic, said Dr. Stephen Federico, Director of Pediatrics for Denver Health, in a statement. The focus moving forward needs to be on vaccination, including boosters for teens and adults, as well as staying home and getting tested when we're sick. The lifting of this mandate does not mean that individuals should not or cannot mask. DPS has required students and staff members to wear face coverings in school buildings since August. Masks will no longer be required in DPS facilities starting February 28th, which is 3 days after Denver's mandate expires. Tay Anderson, vice president of the Denver School Board, said Wednesday that he believed the board should take up the issue of whether or not to end the mask mandate, writing in a Medium post that he wanted to add masks to the district's dress code temporarily, but he did not have the support for such a policy. I must express my deep concerns with ending our mask mandate before the end of the school year, he wrote. I still believe that out of an abundance of caution, our mask mandate should stay in place throughout the remainder of the semester. Federal and state officials are encouraging people to keep wearing masks in indoor spaces, including schools, while transmission remains elevated, even as governments lift their mandates. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention also recommends universal masking in K-12 schools, with Director Rochelle Walensky telling Reuters, "We have and continue to recommend masking in areas of high and substantial transmission. That is essentially everywhere in the country, in public indoor settings. Transmission of the virus remains high despite the drop in COVID-19 cases, as Colorado is still emerging from a wave driven by the highly contagious Omicron variant. The state recorded more than 21,000 new infections last week, which is still near the peak of the Delta variant surge in fall 2021. Hospitalizations from the virus also are declining, but they too remain well above previous lows, while deaths have increased. Denver officials encourage parents to get their children ages 5 and older vaccinated against the coronavirus, including getting boosters for those 12 and older. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration is still determining the safety of COVID-19 shots for children younger than 5 years old, according to the news release. The best way to protect children is to make sure they stay up to date with their vaccinations and ensure that the adults around them are vaccinated as well, said Denver's Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Sterling McLaren, in a statement. Pandemic restrictions. Under pressure to ease up, Biden weighs new response, by Zeke Miller, The Associated Press, byline, Washington. Facing growing pressure to ease up on pandemic restrictions, the White House insisted Wednesday it is making plans for a less disruptive phase of the national virus response. But impatient states, including Democratic New York, made clear they aren't waiting for Washington as public frustration grows. Governor Kathy Hochul announced that New York will end its COVID-19 mandate requiring face coverings in most indoor public settings, but will keep it for schools. Illinois announced the same. Earlier this week, New Jersey, Connecticut, and Delaware all disclosed plans to join states that have lifted or never had mask requirements for their schools, and Massachusetts will follow suit at the end of the month. All but Massachusetts have governors who are Democrats. Biden, a Democrat who has long promised to follow the science in confronting the pandemic, is hemmed in, waiting for fresh guidance from federal health officials who so far still recommend that nearly all Americans wear masks in most indoor settings. Defending Biden, Press Secretary Jen Psaki acknowledged that while people are tired of masks and we understand where the emotions of the country are, the administration is following the advice of medical experts who rely on scientific evidence. That doesn't move at the speed of politics. It moves at the speed of data, she said. Clearly feeling the pressure, the White House for the first time acknowledged movement in its planning, saying conversations have been underway privately to develop plans for guiding the country away from the emergency phase of the pandemic. Federal COVID-19 coordinator Jeff Zients said officials are consulting with state and local leaders and public health officials on potential next steps. But as governors and local officials press for clearer federal guidelines for easing or ending restrictions, states, cities, and school boards are adopting an awkward patchwork of policies that differ widely from one place to the next. We are working on that guidance, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky said in a White House teleconference Wednesday. As we've been encouraged by the current trends, we are not there yet. The White House offered no timetable for the review or an indication of what it will recommend, and some critics say that's not good enough. The tragic thing is that these are governors that would probably have followed the White House's guidance, said Dr. Leanna Wen, a former Baltimore Health Commissioner. They wanted CDC input and asked for it, but without a clear timeline, at some point they had to decide that they couldn't wait anymore. The fault is not theirs, but the CDC's, and by extension, President Biden's, which with each passing day is making itself less and less relevant. Asked whether Biden appears to be out of touch with the country, Psaki defended his caution. As a federal government, we have the responsibility to rely on data, on science, on the medical experts, she said. Pressed on whether Americans should follow less restrictive state or local rules or the stricter federal guidance, she repeated the White House's daily counsel. We would advise any American to follow the CDC guidelines. New York's Hochul and others aren't waiting. They are ending or easing many broad mandates, although her state will keep masking rules in schools and health facilities. Given the declining cases, given the declining hospitalizations, that is why we feel comfortable to lift this in effect tomorrow, Hochul said Wednesday. Even allies of the administration have argued that Biden should at least lay out a roadmap for moving back toward normalcy. He has been hesitant, aides say, in part because of the sting of his fleeting declaration of independence from the virus last summer, which proved premature in the face of the Delta and then Omicron strains. Now, though, cases and hospitalizations from COVID-19 have dropped markedly since they peaked this year, amid the spread of the highly transmissible Omicron variant. And the vast majority of Americans are protected against the virus by effective vaccines and boosters. Still, more than 2,000 people infected with the virus die in the U.S. each day. And there is concern within the administration about letting up while deaths remain high. And Psaki noted that many Americans support continued mask wearing. Some in the White House point to the consternation that was voiced in December after the CDC shortened the isolation time for Americans who test positive. While Biden and other administration officials emphasize that the threat from the virus is far diminished from a year ago, before the wide rollout of vaccines and booster shots and the approval of rapid at-home tests and highly effective therapeutics, administration officials acknowledge most federal guidelines have been slow to keep up. Olivia Gant case. Mother receives 16 years in prison. Turner was accused of pretending her daughter was sick. By Shelley Bradbury, The Denver Post. 5 years after Olivia Gant, 7, died in a Denver hospice after being fed only popsicles and juice for 19 days, a judge on Wednesday sentenced her mother to 16 years in prison for causing the girl's death. Kelly Turner, 44, pleaded guilty in January to a felony charge of child abuse that negligently caused her daughter's death. As part of the plea agreement, charges of first-degree murder against Turner were dismissed, and the prosecution and defense agreed to the 16-year prison term. Turner also pleaded guilty to felony theft and fraud charges, for which she received a combined 13-year prison sentence to be served at the same time as a 16-year sentence. Turner was accused of pretending for years that Olivia was sick when she was actually healthy, and of manipulating doctors at Children's Hospital Colorado into putting Olivia through a series of unnecessary and at times life-threatening procedures. Turner ultimately convinced Olivia's medical team that Olivia should be discharged to hospice, where she was heavily medicated and given no nutrition until she died. At the time, some doctors and nurses at Children's Hospital Colorado raised concerns that Turner might be medically abusing Olivia, but the hospital did not alert outside authorities before Olivia died, despite the state's mandated reporting laws, a Denver Post investigation found. Instead, the hospital investigated with its own internal child protection team, which decided there was no need to alert outside authorities. If anybody spoke up and protected Olivia, she would be here today, her grandfather, Lonnie Gatrow, said in a statement read in court Wednesday. He wept during the sentencing and called for changes to the state's mandatory reporting laws to help protect other children. Olivia was a high-profile patient at Children's Hospital Colorado who was featured in the hospital's marketing materials. Her mother fed on that attention and status, the Post found. Doctors and caregivers at Children's Hospital Colorado missed or dismissed several warning signs that Olivia's supposed illness might not be real, the Post found. A spokeswoman for the hospital declined to comment on Wednesday's sentencing. Ira Ohanian, Turner's public defender, said during the sentencing that Olivia suffered legitimate medical problems and that Turner did not kill the girl. She is not guilty of murdering her child, he said. The plea we took in this case is negligent child abuse. He said the case turned when doctors and attorneys from Children's Hospital Colorado sat down with the defense and talked the attorneys through their decision-making. Ohanian then offered a lengthy defense of the doctor's actions. The hospital in September resolved a $25 million civil claim by Olivia's family in a confidential deal. Christopher Gallo, 18th Judicial District Chief Deputy District Attorney, said during the sentencing that the plea agreement was not complete justice, not perfect justice, but was some level of justice. It is an unfortunate and very frustrating thing that the most insidious crimes a person can commit are also the most difficult to prosecute and prove, he said. District Judge Patricia Heron imposed the agreed-on sentence and, in a surprise move, also ordered that Turner cannot benefit financially from Olivia's death. Whether that be because of a movie consultation, book consultation, or book deals, Heron said, the order is Ms. Turner shall not and will not for the rest of her life be allowed to benefit further financially from this case or the facts connected with this case. Should such deals generate any money for Turner, that money must be donated to the charities that she defrauded, Heron said. Police issue warrant for Peters. It offers details on Mesa County Clerk's arrest at bagel shop. By Saja Hindi, the Denver Post. Grand Junction Police have issued a warrant Wednesday for the arrest of Mesa County Clerk and Recorder Tina Peters on suspicion of obstruction of a peace officer. Arrest documents released Wednesday detailed the Republican clerk's detainment on Tuesday morning at a Grand Junction bagel shop as investigators attempted to obtain an iPad that belonged to Peters. Officers released her that same day, pending charges. As of 5 p.m. Wednesday, Peters had not been arrested on the warrant for the misdemeanor charge. A $500 bail was set. Mesa County District Attorney's investigators requested the help of Grand Junction Police with someone obstructing their investigation, according to the affidavit. The District Attorney's office was attempting to obtain Peters' iPad, which he allegedly may have used against a judge's order, to record a court hearing for Deputy Clerk Belinda Nisley, according to the search warrant signed Tuesday. Any possible charge from that investigation is separate from the charge police pursued Wednesday. When Grand Junction police officers arrived at Main Street Bagels, they saw district attorney's investigators in a heated discussion with a group of people seated and standing near the front table inside the business, according to the report written by Officer Von Soderquist. And the iPad investigators were trying to take was being passed around from person to person, he said. Peters also kept obstructing the officer's access, according to the report. Soderquist wrote that he grabbed Peters by her biceps and moved her toward other officers as he attempted to talk to someone else, and she began actively resisting, so she was put in handcuffs for allegedly obstructing. Peters continued resisting as officers tried to lock the handcuffs and get her car key out of her hand when she kicked back, missing an officer but hitting his magazine pouch and taser, the report stated. That's when officers shouted at Peters not to kick as she yelled at them, Soderquist wrote, as can be seen in a video provided by a witness to 9 News. Officers then led her outside, where a woman was recording as Peters allegedly continued to resist. Officers told the woman recording to step back as he tried to search Peters, but then Peters had the woman recording come up to her to whisper something in her ear, according to the officer. The woman wouldn't step away, so they escorted Peters to the officer's car, the report stated. Peters continued struggling with the officers as they led her to the car and searched her, Soderquist said. But she immediately calmed down when she got in the patrol car and out of view of people with cameras. As I was attempting to buckle her, she asked if I knew what I was doing, and then she stated I was assisting a Merrick Garland, Soderquist wrote. She continued talking about something pertaining to the election as I closed the patrol car door, but this was indiscernible as she was almost whispering once in the car. Soderquist said district attorney's investigators informed officers who the suspect was, Peters, and that they were pursuing potential charges related to tampering with physical evidence and obstruction, so police shouldn't file a duplicate obstruction charge. The officers released Peters at their request. A district attorney's investigator told Peters why he was taking the silver iPad, which she said wasn't hers, and she told the investigator she wished he would investigate election fraud issues, according to the report. After Peters got out of the car, she allegedly ignored the investigator and had someone take pictures of her wrists, complaining she was injured, but she refused an ambulance. She said the iPad belonged to someone named Tammy Bailey, but wouldn't give any other information before walking away, according to the report. The district attorney's office ultimately decided not to file a felony charge, which is why the Grand Junction Police Department is seeking a charge of obstructing a peace officer charge and an arrest warrant, according to the report. District Attorney Dan Rubenstein told the Denver Post in an email that although there was probable cause for the felony charge, he didn't feel that the conduct justified the level of filing since the evidence tampered with was ultimately recovered. But the obstruction charge has been filed. In a written statement from Peter's Legal Defense Fund, spokesperson Rory McShane reiterated that the search warrant Tuesday included only the iPad and not car keys or searching of Peter's. The statement alleged that officers left bruises, contusions, and injuries to her wrists and arms, and that this continues the theme of excessive force and harassment that Clerk Peters has dealt with for months, including battering rams used on homes during searches. Peters has been the subject of investigations, including most recently a grand jury investigation into allegations of election equipment tampering and official misconduct in Mesa County. Peters is accused of allegedly allowing unauthorized access to elections equipment during a Dominion voting system software update in May, as well as allegedly breaching election security protocols, after which passwords from the voting equipment were posted online. A judge barred her and Nisley from overseeing the 2021 election in Mesa County, and the Secretary of State's office has sued to stop Peters from overseeing the 2022 election after Peters refused to comply with new protocols. Peters is also facing state ethics and campaign finance complaints. Colorado will get $10 million to fight coal seam fires. Colorado will get nearly $10 million from the federal government to combat abandoned coal mine fires, officials announced this week. The decision comes after authorities say they are investigating abandoned coal mines as a possible cause to the December 30th fire that burned more than 1,100 homes and businesses in Boulder County. The investigation into the most destructive fire in state history is also looking at power lines, human activity, and other possibilities. The funds are part of the federal government's plan to put $11.3 billion toward reclaiming and cleaning up abandoned landmines over the next 15 years, the Department of Interior said in a news release Tuesday. At least 259 underground mine fires burned in more than a dozen states as of September, according to Federal Office of Surface Mining data. There are possibly thousands more undocumented blazes burning in coal seams that have never been mined, researchers and government officials say. These fires emit toxic mercury and the greenhouse gas carbon dioxide. They cause sinkholes when the ground surface collapses. This is from the Associated Press. Skier, 77, dies after hitting tree at Eldora. The Boulder County Coroner's Office has identified the woman killed Tuesday after crashing into a tree at Eldora as Barbara Nelson, 77, of Erie. According to the sheriff's office, dispatchers were called at 2:26 p.m. Tuesday to the Eldora ski area outside Netherland after a woman, later identified as Nelson, was found unconscious and not breathing on the Mule Shoe Run. Emergency crews attempted life-saving measures, but she was pronounced dead at Eldora's first aid room about 3 p.m. Investigators believe at this time Nelson crashed into a tree while skiing. The coroner's office has completed an examination, and the cause and manner of her death are pending. This is from the Daily Camera. Boulder King Supers reopens. Today is a time to reclaim what is ours, by Deborah Swearingen, the Daily Camera. Byline, Boulder. The King Supers on Table Mesa Drive has officially reopened, bringing with it all the emotions one might expect, everything from excitement and relief to anxiety and uncertainty. Grocery store employees and city officials gathered with the community on Wednesday morning outside of the newly redesigned store in South Boulder for a ceremony. It was an opportunity for people to remember the 10 lives lost in a March 22nd mass shooting at the grocery store, a community hub for many. The event began with music and speakers and concluded with a human-formed tunnel outside of the grocery store's entrance meant to welcome King Soopers workers back inside. But it also served as a time for reclamation, according to Mayor Aaron Brockett, one of about 10 people who spoke at the event. Today is a time to reclaim what is ours, a beloved neighborhood grocery store, a community gathering space, Brockett said. In a close-knit community like South Boulder, trips to the grocery store inevitably mean running into someone that you care about and connecting for a minute over the bread in the bread aisle. There were tears and cheers as people left the weight of what it meant to return to the store that means so much to so many. I've been looking forward to this day for a long time, store lead Sherry Bossman said, choking up. We were strong before. We continue to build our strength. We're stronger than ever, she said. All I ask for is peace. The Table Mesa King Soopers was closed for nearly a year while under construction. The redesign, which is based on feedback from employees and the community, features a new entryway, large windows, and lifted ceilings, among other design details. Katie Fry and Carly Grunholm were among the many community members who attended Wednesday's ceremony. They both were relieved to return to grocery shopping at the South Boulder store. Before the Table Mesa store reopened, Grunholm had been shopping at the King Soopers on 30th Street. Last week, she and an employee who worked at the 30th Street store while the Table Mesa store was being remodeled shared their excitement about the upcoming reopening. It's pretty emotional, Fry agreed, but I think they did a great job with the ceremony. It's really meaningful and great to see all our familiar faces. I wasn't sure who would be coming back. Of about 200 total employees at the Table Mesa store, King Soopers has said that 50% are returning to work there. The staff were honored Wednesday, welcomed in by the University of Colorado Marching Band. Terry Leiker, a decades-long King Soopers employee who died in the shooting, was a huge CU fan. When Governor Jared Polis heard the band begin to play, he couldn't help but think that Terry Leiker is smiling somewhere. Still, despite the excitement that was palpable during Wednesday's ceremony, some people acknowledge that they're continuing to feel some uncertainty and anxiety about it all, particularly as it relates to their children. The Table Mesa store is Christina Gardner's home store. Gardner said she and her children are glad the store is reopening, but also feel a bit uncertain. I know they won't see Terry like they used to and know the full gravity of what occurred in their favorite grocery store, Gardner said, referring to Leiker. Annie Hedgepeth agreed, noting she and her kids also feel a bit nervous to return. There's some collective community trauma that hasn't been thoroughly addressed, Hedgepeth said. I still plan on going, but it's not something I'm looking forward to. Kelly McGannon, a King Soopers spokesperson, recognized the trauma and grief that community members continue to experience. She also noted the community found hope through tragedy. In June, the Table Mesa King Soopers will open a remembrance tree garden on the west corner of the parking lot with 10 trees in honor of the lives lost. The store hopes it will be a place for quiet reflection. Additionally, during Wednesday's event, the store included a ceremonial element it hoped would acknowledge that spirit of unity and hope. As the ceremony concluded, city leadership and King Soopers employees tied a knot with two pieces of a ribbon instead of the typical ribbon cutting ceremony held at the opening of a store. Boulder is far more than a place, McGannon said. Boulder is a feeling. New State Senate President Fenberg to succeed Garcia by Alex Burness, The Denver Post. Colorado State Senate Democrats voted Wednesday to name Boulder's Steve Fenberg president of the chamber and Commerce City's Dominic Moreno leader of the caucus. Thunberg, majority leader since 2019, will take over for the outgoing Senate President Leroy Garcia of Pueblo, who on February 23rd will step down to take a job in the Department of Defense. Moreno will take over as majority leader. Senator Rachel Zinsinger of Arvada will take over for Moreno on the Joint Budget Committee. The shuffle is expected to become official once the full Senate votes to approve a new president later this month. Moreno is a five-year veteran and former chair of the Joint Budget Committee, a powerful group of six lawmakers with substantial control over a state budget expected to reach about $40 billion this year. These positions will all run through at least this year. But the November election could swing the chamber back to Republican control for the first time since 2018. Democrats now hold 20 of the Senate's 35 seats, and they'll have to work to defend that turf following the recent decadal redistricting process, which yielded at least six likely competitive races among the 35 districts. Republicans expect a stronger than usual showing in 2022. Polling suggests as much, too. After years of electoral lashings in this state, and they need to flip only three seats to win back the Senate. The role of president is to oversee the Senate, presiding over daily work on the chamber floor, deciding whether or not certain bills can be introduced, choosing when the chamber should hear gubernatorial appointments. The president also commands a full-time staff, whereas most senators only have part-time aides. Garcia is a hands-off leader who has been reluctant to wield many of the powers conferred upon him as president and who prefers to lead members to find their own paths. Thunberg, much more the policy wonk and political tactician, is expected to behave differently in that role. My number one priority at the end of the day has been the well-being and what's best for this caucus. By no means does that mean everyone has agreed with every decision I've made, Thunberg said at Wednesday's caucus meeting. But if I had an issue with anyone, a disagreement with a bill, I try to approach every situation with honesty and humility. Other senators were interested in the job, but only Thunberg and Vail's Kerry Donovan officially declared intent to run. Donovan argued the chamber would benefit from a woman leader who lives west of the Front Range. 11 of the 20 caucus members are women, yet its four most powerful leadership roles, the president, majority leader, and the group's two joint budget committee delegates, all have been men for the past 2 years. Donovan was absent Wednesday due to a family death, her colleague said, and so Thunberg ended up unopposed. He'd have won anyway, senators believe. Moving forward, all four of these critical caucus roles will be held by people from the Front Range. It will soon be the case that the three people with the biggest jobs at the Capitol are all Boulderites. Thunberg and Governor Jared Polis live there, and Speaker Alec Garnett grew up there, but lives in Denver now. The majority leader is a strategist and legislative director for the caucus. That person sets the calendar for the chamber and serves as their party's unofficial chief liaison to the minority. There were at least a half dozen senators who were interested in being majority leader, but Moreno, who is respected by colleagues for his calm and his budget savvy, cleared the field and ended up running unopposed. After thinking on it over the past weekend, Moreno told the Denver Post, "It began to feel like not running was actually, oddly, the very selfish thing to do, to not assume a role that other people have confidence you can do." Uniquely among his Senate colleagues, Moreno is a frequent and frank critic of Polis, a Boulder Democrat who leans libertarian or even outright conservative on fiscal issues in particular. This frustrates many Democratic lawmakers, but even the most progressive among them generally choose their words carefully when discussing the governor. "I certainly will always be willing to speak my mind," Moreno said. "I think it's important to have balance. In this situation, I think Thunberg is more close to the governor's office than I am. I think what's important to note is this has never been personal for me in any way. For me, it has always been a separation of powers issue. I take that very personally. I've always considered myself a guardian of the legislative institution, and that's not something I want to back down on." New service plan. RTD gives public more time to comment, by John Murray, the Denver Post. transit riders and other Metro Denver residents will get an extra 4 weeks to weigh in on regional transportation district plan that could improve service in more populated areas in coming years while phasing out some outlying suburban routes. Several RTD board members had pushed for an extension of the comment period for the system optimization plan, which had been set to expire Wednesday, just 4 weeks after RTD announced its release. The public will now have until March 9th to comment on specific route-by-route proposals or the overall plan, which is intended to be implemented gradually through 2027. It was produced through the agency's ongoing Reimagine RTD initiative. Deborah Johnson, RTD's general manager and CEO, said during a board committee meeting Tuesday night that the agency had convened 28 meetings since December and received more than 500 comments, including through the plan's online mapping tool. RTD leaders are considering more outreach efforts, including additional public meetings and advertising. I would note that over 80% of the feedback has been focused on the desire for new or expanded service, Johnson said. Many of those commenters are bound to be disappointed. Amid RTD's significant pandemic challenges, the agency's leaders have set up a goal of restoring service to just 85% of prior levels by 2027, up from roughly 70% now. RTD would use the optimization plan to adjust many routes so that they can serve more riders with greater frequency in key corridors. Some, but not all, of the suspended Flatiron Flyer Express bus routes would be restored over time. But more than a dozen bus routes with low ridership would be eliminated, replaced by an expansion of RTD's on-demand shared ride flex ride service. The plan would usher in the greatest overhaul of RTD's bus network in decades. The currently suspended C and F rail lines also would be eliminated. The plan has most remaining light rail lines for eventual upgrades to service every 10 minutes, once RTD has the money and staffing. Riders affected by the loss of the C and F lines would face shorter waits for train transfers along the southwest and southeast corridors. RTD's board had been expected to vote on the optimization plan in March, but the extended comment period may push back that decision. The public also can weigh in on the plan by emailing communityengagement@rtd-denver.com or by calling 303-489-7792. Kara Nichols went missing in 2012, murder suspect arrested after possible remains found, by Jake Shapiro, the Denver Post. The El Paso County Sheriff's Office arrested a suspect following the discovery of the possible remains of Kara Nichols, a woman who has been missing for nearly 10 years, officials announced Tuesday night. Police say Joel Hollendorfer, 46, was arrested and booked into the El Paso County Jail on suspicion of second-degree murder and tampering with physical evidence. Nichols, then 19, was last seen by a family member on October 9, 2012, in unincorporated El Paso County. Her family reported her missing on October 14, 2012. During a January cold case review, a witness was located and interviewed. That person gave critical information and provided a new lead, investigators say. On Monday, a team of El Paso Sheriff's investigators and the FBI Evidence Response Team executed a search warrant in the 9600 block of Burgess Road in Colorado Springs. The Sheriff's Office said the search led to the recovery of female human remains, which the El Paso County Coroner's Office tentatively identified as Nichols on Tuesday. On a Facebook page titled Justice for Kara Nichols, a family member shared their heartbreak. It is with profound sadness and a heavy heart that we share that we were informed yesterday by authorities that our beautiful daughter's remains were found and a suspect has been arrested in the case, a post read. Due to the unremitting support and help from National Women's Coalition Against Violence and Exploitation, NWCAVE, the past decade, they will continue to be by our family's side, manage this page, and be a voice for Kara as we seek justice in this case. Officials say investigators have spent hundreds of hours working the case. Dozens of search warrants have been executed, and numerous leads have come in over the duration of the investigation, spanning the United States and Europe. Investigators stress the complexity of the case and ask for those with information to call 719-520-6666. Thornton. Counsel Boots Phillips, Saying She's Not a Resident, by John Aguilar, The Denver Post. The city council in Thornton narrowly voted to remove one of its own on Wednesday after a marathon meeting that went into the early morning hours and involved more than 3 hours of public comment. The council voted 5-4, declaring that six-year Ward 1 councilwoman Jackie Phillips did not meet the city's residency requirements. After it was revealed last year that she had purchased a home in Alamosa and listed it as her primary residence on a loan document, according to Thornton spokesman Todd Barnes. The removal took effect immediately, and the council has 30 days to appoint a successor. The issue, Barnes said, arose when the city council learned last fall that Phillips had taken a job as the executive director of the San Luis Valley BOCES in Alamosa, an educational enrichment organization that works with local school districts. Phillips, who was represented by her own attorney at Tuesday night's meeting, claims she still owns a house in Thornton and still runs a law practice in the city, Barnes said. I'm really sad for Ward 1 today. This is wrong, Phillips told the Denver Post. It was a political move with the only goal being to further entrench the majority on Thornton City Council. Boulder County. Parents advocate for end to school mask mandate, by Amy Bounds. Daily Camera. As surrounding school districts drop mask requirements, some area parents are intensifying campaigns to persuade Boulder County Public Health to allow local students to unmask in the classroom. Several parents spoke at Tuesday's Boulder Valley School Board meeting, urging the board to stop requiring masks. The school board didn't address the masks as an agenda item, but a general update from the public health officials is scheduled for the board's February 22nd meeting. Boulder Valley officials have said they will continue to follow public health guidance. Boulder County Public Health's current public health order, which requires masks for students ages 2 and older and for staff members in schools and child care facilities, has been in place since August. The mandate applies to the Boulder Valley and St. Vrain Valley school districts. The Boulder County Board of Health's next opportunity to discuss the county's indoor mask mandate is at its Monday meeting. An agenda hasn't been posted yet. Other counties in Colorado have ended their mask orders for indoor settings, including for school districts, as the latest surge in COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations fall. But a member of Colorado's COVID-19 modeling team said Monday that getting rid of masks is premature when the virus remains widespread, noting many kids remain unvaccinated. The American Academy of Pediatrics also continues to recommend that everyone age 2 and older wear masks inside schools. In recent weeks, COVID-19 cases steadily decreased in Colorado and Boulder County. On January 5th, the 7-day percent positivity for diagnostic tests increased to 24.5% in Boulder County. The rate sharply dropped to 13.1% by February 1st, according to Boulder County Public Health's dashboard. Surrounding school districts that have dropped their mask requirements include Adams 12 and Thompson Valley. Jeffco Schools is planning to no longer require masks starting February 18th. Broomfield also ended its mask mandate, but Boulder Valley officials said they will continue to operate under one set of health precautions and so won't change the mask requirements at the district's 6 schools in Broomfield. In St. Vrain Valley, which is following Boulder County's public health order for the entire school district, whether schools are in Boulder or Weld counties, a district charter school on the Weld side of Erie decided last week to no longer require masks. Weld County doesn't have an indoor mask mandate. Parents remain divided on the topic. Although more parents and medical professionals have begun calling for a discussion of the trade-offs of mask wearing for children, some continue to say cases are still too high to drop masks as a layer of protection inside schools, arguing that masks are needed to protect medically vulnerable students and prevent transmission. Others want masks to be a choice, saying wearing a high-quality mask will protect those with medical conditions, regardless of whether others around them are masks. On Tuesday, parent Shannon Wiesblatt urged the board to follow Jeffco Schools by advocating for an end date for Boulder County Public Health's mask mandate. "It's been 2 long years," she said. "It's really time." After quoting an Emily Dickinson poem about hope, Speaker Emery Butler urged the board to remove the burden that is weighing down our kids. "The mask mandate cannot go on forever," he said. Parents opposed to masks also spoke at the January 25th school board meeting, saying face coverings are adding to students' mental health and learning challenges. Erin McHugh said her daughter experiences increased anxiety when wearing masks, while incidents of violence and vandalism are on the rise at her school. In related news, Vail drops mask mandate for public buildings. Face coverings are recommended, but they are no longer mandatory inside Vail public buildings. The town's mandatory face covering requirement for access to public buildings had been in place since August 23, 2021. The requirement had applied to the municipal complex, Vail Public Library, welcome centers, fire stations, transit centers, and the public works shops. Moving forward, the town of Vail will continue to follow the lead and protocols set by Eagle County. Face coverings continue to be required on all public transportation until March 18th because of a federal mandate. This is from the Vail Daily. Pitkin County Public Health recommends mandate be dropped. The Pitkin County Public Health staff will recommend that members of the Board of Health drop all local COVID-19 related restrictions, including the indoor mask mandate, when they meet Thursday. That was the word Tuesday from Pitkin County Manager John Peacock, who told commissioners that the end of local COVID-19 requirements could come as soon as February 18th, the beginning of President's Day weekend. Eliminating the indoor mask requirement for children in school and in childcare facilities will be part of the recommendation. Public health officials have been coordinating the recommendation with local schools officials, who have said they need a bit of time to adjust their operations before the unmasking, Peacock said. Pitkin County's indoor mask mandate for schools and childcare facilities was put in place by the Board of Health in August, while the general community-wide mandate began about a month later in September. This article was from the Aspen Times. In local news briefs, suspect in killings is arrested in Kansas. A man suspected of killing 2 people in Douglas County has been arrested in Salina, Kansas. KDVR Channel 31 reported Wednesday evening. Casey Duvall was taken into custody without incident and will remain in jail there until extradition to Colorado, the TV station said. Police say Duvall, 29, of Franktown, killed a man and woman. Police believe the murders happened late Monday or early Tuesday. Man shot, killed by Aurora police, identified as church shooting suspect. A man shot dead by Aurora police on Wednesday has been identified as the 31-year-old suspect in a shooting that killed 1 woman and injured 2 men at a church Friday night. Jose de Jesus Montoya Villa was on an armed crime rampage Wednesday, including alleged carjacking and a shooting, when he was stopped by Aurora police and shot, said Matthew Longshore, a police spokesman. Longshore said that Villa, driving a stolen car, was stopped by officers about 4:40 p.m. at East Jamison Avenue and South Parker Road. Villa pointed a gun at officers, who opened fire on the suspect. In Friday night's shooting at Iglesia Faro de Luz, 538 Olathe Street, a 36-year-old woman was killed and a 40-year-old man and a 42-year-old man were wounded, police said. On Wednesday evening, Villa was taken to a hospital where he was pronounced dead. "I am extremely relieved that my officers were not injured this evening," Aurora Police Chief Vanessa Wilson said on Twitter. "They stopped a dangerous criminal from further victimizing our community." The string of crimes Wednesday started about 3:40 p.m. with a shooting in the area of Dayton Street and East 8th Avenue, Longshore said. One person was shot and taken to a hospital. Police said Villa was involved in the shooting and then carjacked a nearby vehicle a short time later. After the shooting and carjacking, a liquor store was robbed, allegedly by Villa, on Peoria Street. About 4:30 p.m., Villa allegedly carried out another carjacking near I-225 and Parker Road, Longshore said. About 4:40 p.m., officers spotted the carjacked vehicle and stopped it near East Jamison Avenue and Parker Road. Teen sentenced to 35 years in prison for shooting death of Lakewood man. A 19-year-old was sentenced Tuesday to 35 years in prison for the shooting death of a 65-year-old Lakewood man. Caleb Hassan Brewer was sentenced for the March 2020 death of Robert Stege, according to the Jefferson County District Attorney's Office. Brewer pleaded guilty to second-degree murder after reaching an agreement to the 35-year sentence, the district attorney's office said in a new release. Stege's family addressed the court at the sentencing and described the shooting victim as a devoted caretaker and beloved husband, uncle, and friend. The release said, the family stated that Robert was very forgiving and they believed that the plea agreement is what he would have wanted. On March 9, 2020, Stege was sitting inside his vehicle in the driveway of his home after returning from grocery shopping when Brewer, who was attempting to rob the vehicle, shot Stege twice. BNSF employee is hit by train, dies. A railroad employee hit by a train in Denver on Wednesday morning died of his injuries. The man was hit by a train in the area of the 3700 block of Globeville Road, according to police. The address of the incident is part of the BNSF railway yard north of Coors Field. About 3:40 p.m., police announced the man had died. His name will be released by the Denver Medical Examiner's Office pending notification of family. These were from staff and wire reports. Capital breach. January 6 inquiry subpoenas former advisor Navarro by Luke Broadwater, The New York Times Company, Byline, Washington. The House committee investigating the January 6 attack on the Capitol on Wednesday issued a subpoena to Peter Navarro, a White House advisor to former President Donald Trump, who was involved in what he called an operation to keep Trump in office after he lost the 2020 election. The subpoena was the committee's latest attempt to obtain information about efforts in Trump's White House to invalidate the election. In his book, In Trump Time, and in interviews with the New York Times and other outlets, Navarro has said he worked with Steve Bannon and other allies of Trump to develop and carry out a plan to delay Congress's formal count of the 2020 presidential election results to buy time to change the outcome. Representative Benny Thompson, Democrat of Mississippi, leader of the committee, said Navarro hasn't been shy about his role in efforts to overturn the results of the 2020 election and has even discussed the former president's support for those plans. Navarro has insisted the violence on January 6 was not part of his plans, which he said included having Vice President Mike Pence reject electors for Joe Biden when Congress met in a joint session to count them formally. There has been no evidence of widespread fraud or irregularities in the 2020 election, although Trump continues to claim it was stolen from him. Navarro also wrote a 36-page report alleging election fraud. In an interview with the New York Times, he said he relied on thousands of affidavits from Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, and Bernard Carrick, a former New York police commissioner, to help produce the report, which claimed there may well have been a coordinated strategy to effectively stack the election deck against the Trump-Pence ticket. The January 6 committee described the claims in Navarro's report as having been discredited in public reporting by state officials and courts. Navarro said he made sure Republican members of Congress received a copy of his report and that more than 100 members of Congress had signed onto the plans. Navarro said Wednesday he would respond to the January 6 committee subpoena shortly. Coronavirus. Protesters block third border point. Ford plant shuts down. By Rob Gillies and Tom Krischer, the Associated Press. Truck blockades of Canada's capital and U.S. border crossings, including the economically vital bridge to Detroit, forced the shutdown of a Ford plant, and the company warned the protests could have wider implications for the North American auto industry. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, meanwhile, stood firm against the easing of Canada's COVID-19 restrictions in the face of mounting pressure during recent weeks by protests against the restrictions and against Trudeau himself. A blockade by people in pickups entered its third day at the Ambassador Bridge between Detroit and Windsor, Ontario. Traffic was prevented from entering Canada, while U.S.-bound traffic was still moving. The bridge carries 25% of all trade between the countries, and Canadian authorities express increasing worry about the economic effects. Ford said late Wednesday that parts shortages forced it to shut down its engine plant in Windsor and to run an assembly plant in Oakville, Ontario, on a reduced schedule. This interruption on the Detroit-Windsor Bridge hurts customers, auto workers, suppliers, communities, and companies on both sides of the border, Ford said. We hope the situation is resolved quickly because it could have widespread impact on all automakers in the U.S. and Canada. Shortages because of the blockade also forced General Motors to cancel a second shift of its day at its mid-size SUV factory near Lansing, Michigan. Spokesman Dan Flores said it was expected to restart Thursday and no additional impact was expected for the time being. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.